Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump's choice to head the Justice Department, William Barr, begins his nomination hearings today before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Barr has pledged not to hamper or end the Mueller investigation, and he spent last week paying calls on committee members. He was previously Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush. Next, the New York Times reported today that a year ago, President Trump suggested to aides that the United States should withdraw from NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He made the statement several more times throughout 2018, calling it a financial drain on the U.S. A U.S. withdrawal would likely signal the end of the alliance. Then the Los Angeles teacher strike entered its second day today with no immediate end in sight. Why won't the L.A. Unified School District reduce class sizes, hire more nurses, counselors, and librarians, and give teachers a raise when the district is sitting on a $1.86 billion surplus? Today, huge pickets are continuing, and charter school teachers are joining the strike. And then today, we continue our regular segment, which we'll do every Tuesday, called Women in Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. And finally, Representative Steve King, a Republican of Iowa, will be stripped of his committee assignments because of racist comments he made last week. But King has been making similar comments for years, and the Republican leadership has never said a word. Senator Chuck Grassley even endorsed him for re-election last year. Why are the Republicans acting now? And does this mean the end of King's career? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Capitol Hill. President Trump's choice to head the Justice Department, William Barr, begins his nomination hearings today before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Barr has pledged not to hamper or end the Mueller investigation, and he spent last week paying courtesy calls on committee members. He was previously Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush, and he was confirmed unanimously back then. We're joined from Seattle by Brad Schlesinger. He's a criminal defense attorney there. Brad, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Brad, we've been watching these hearings on and off all day, and the new Attorney General designate, William Barr, appears to be telling senators on both sides of the aisle what they want to hear. The Democrats wanted to make sure that he wouldn't end or impede in any way the Mueller investigation. Republicans just want to make sure that he's as conservative as he used to be. What's it look like for William Barr? Is he going to make it through committee and then through the Senate?
It seems like he's probably going to make it on through and be confirmed as Attorney General, which is pretty upsetting because it's probably hard to find somebody who could be described as worse than Jeff Sessions, but Bill Barr pretty much hits those points. The Republicans control the Senate. It's with some Democrats who are still in there who are centrist, lean towards the right. It doesn't look good for his nomination to be stopped in its tracks. I think the most likely outcome is that the nomination goes through committee and he gets a full vote on the Senate and he'll be the next Attorney General, which creates all sorts of issues in our country.
You know, this is a guy too, and most Americans don't remember this, but when he was Attorney General, he segregated would-be refugees who were HIV positive and put them into what became known as HIV prison camps and left them there uncharged with any crime. They were in actual prison camps only because of their HIV status. And now that was deemed, of course, to be illegal, but he had no compunction about doing it.
Right. And that's just a small part of some of the really awful things that have occurred under Bill Barr's watch. I mean, like you said, he had no problem imprisoning immigrants. He's very much in favor of a extremely expansive view of executive power that gives the president essentially unlimited ability to do what he wants when it comes to immigration. And when it comes to issues of criminal justice reform, we couldn't have seen the more punitive time when he was Attorney General in the early 90s. He was a big pusher of punitive laws such as the 1990 Crime Control Act. He used Justice Department resources to push for a book arguing for more incarceration. He defended the 100-to-1 crack powder disparity in sentencing that just catches more African-American people than white people. I mean, we're basically talking about a guy whose whole history of in law enforcement as an attorney general is to be as punitive as possible. And he had a lot of success in carrying carrying out those policies. And I don't see anything in the things that he's said or written that puts me in any position to believe that he's changed in any meaningful way on those issues.
That's the voice of Brad Schlesinger. He is a criminal defense attorney. We're talking to Brad from Seattle. Writing in 1992, Barr wrote, this is an article called The Case for Mass Incarceration.
Dreadful.
One of the architects here. You know, it really says something about the Democrats that they want to challenge Barr about whether or not the Mueller probe will continue. Of course it's going to continue. And Mueller and Barr are old friends. I mean, they worked together, you know, in the early 1990s. They're buds. What they don't talk about is this article. And I want to quote a sentence to you from that article, The Case for Mass Incarceration by William Barr. Here it is, 1992. The benefits of increased incarceration would be enjoyed disproportionately by Black Americans living in inner cities who are the victims of violent crime at far higher rates than whites and persons who live outside the inner cities. Talk about an Alice in Wonderland version of reality or fantasy. I mean, here it's Black communities in particular, and of course, Latino communities too, that have been literally ripped apart.
Decimated.
Yes. Families ripped apart because of these draconian laws. It took 200 years from the formation of the Republic for the United States to reach the 1 million mark in terms of the number of people incarcerated. And then it took another 10 to 15 years to get to the 2 million mark. And it's because of guys like William Barr. Go ahead.
Right. I mean, that quote is, it's almost hard to believe that that's not a parody or a joke. The idea that we're going to protect the Black community by putting Black people in prison is just, like you said, you're having an Alice in Wonderland moment. When I heard that Bill Barr was nominated, I had to do a double take because I said to myself, you know, the only person who possibly could have been a worse choice is James Q. Wilson, and he's dead, the inventor of the Black super predator juvenile. I mean, everything that Bill Barr's done just points to the fact that he doesn't have any problem with the racist application of criminal justice. He doesn't think enough juveniles are prosecuted as adults. He thinks that any attempt to reform mandatory minimum or sentencing laws is going to lead to a wave of crime. And he thinks, like you had mentioned, that putting more people in prison is a positive thing and that it reduces crime. However, all the research that we have on this tells us that there's absolutely nothing to support that. In fact, when you look at the mere fact of conviction and incarceration, Pew Charitable Trust shows that if you want to reduce recidivism, you have to reduce putting people into the system to begin with. Merely being a convicted felon and serving time in prison reduces not only one's chances, but their children's chances to move up from the economic tier that they're in to a higher one. So we know the reasons why there are problems in the criminal justice system. It's just really upsetting to see somebody like Bill Barr, who is an antiquated dinosaur in this area, being put up into this position. And the Democrats and most people on the left are just far too focused on this Bob Mueller Russia issue, and they're sort of pushing all of these criminal justice matters, the areas where he can have far more of an impact in guiding policy. And it's just, like you mentioned, it's not something that's making the front pages. It's just it's like an ancillary issue. But really, if we want to know what Bill Barr can do and where he can have an impact, it's on these areas of criminal justice policy that have decimated minority communities and ensured that our prisons are filled up with Black and brown people.
Yeah, again, here's Bill Barr from 1992, his article, The Case for Mass Incarceration. Quote, we are incarcerating too few criminals, close quote. Now, let's just pick that apart. If you go in, as Brad Schlesinger, a criminal defense attorney, does probably every day or many, many days each week, if you go into court, you'll see it's like a factory. It's like a treadmill. And mainly young African-American and young Latino people are being just taken through the system, and everybody pleads guilty to something, because if you go to trial, your rate of conviction is about 95%, I think. So even if you're innocent, your lawyer is likely to tell you, hey, take the lesser charge, plead guilty, you won't spend as much time in prison. That's how the system runs. Now, if you say we are incarcerating too few criminals, there's lots of, quote, crime that are committed in middle class, mainly white suburbs, all kinds of crimes, all kinds of drug use. The issue about who goes to jail or who comes to court is really not about crime. It's more about policing. Are certain communities completely over-policed? And it seems to me, Brad, I don't know, I want to get your opinion on this. It seems to me that that is a core issue here.
That's exactly right. I mean, we basically have, for all intents and purposes, a two-tier justice system. One justice system that deals with white people who are middle class and upper middle class means, and there's another tier that deals with poor minorities. If you're a white person of middle class or upper middle class means, you're probably not going to go to jail. Even if you do get arrested, you're probably going to get some sort of a diversion program where you'll have an opportunity to have your charges dismissed ultimately. But if you're a poor minority, that's typically not what we see. We see that those people are charged extremely heavy. They're charged with very serious crimes. And then maybe they're given the opportunity, like you had mentioned, to plead down and take a charge of a lesser nature, which still results in some sort of jail or prison sentence. And you're right. Whether or not the police are aggressively over-policing certain areas will result in more people entering the system. And this is another point where Bill Barr is woefully inadequate. Like Jeff Sessions, he is a believer in this absurd theory of the Ferguson effect, that if you hold police officers accountable for doing their jobs, then they won't want to do their job and that crime will go up. Well, we know that that's completely ridiculous, that no such Ferguson effect exists. And what the problem here is that, along with Jeff Sessions, Bill Barr doesn't agree in many of the consent decrees that the Justice Department had issued against police departments like in St. Louis, like here in Seattle. So whatever oversight there was of these rogue police departments who were, like you mentioned, engaged in over-policing of minority areas, well, that's all going out the window. Any semblance of oversight or transparency of what these departments are doing under the Jeff Sessions, Bill Barr regime, we just won't know anymore. And whatever metrics they were supposed to comply with to ensure that they were complying with the decrees, the courts no longer have any impact. And so these police departments are free to go back and police the ways that they were in the years before the Justice Department got involved in their departments.
Yeah, and I have to say, John, when I was just looking at those hearings a little bit in between interviews today, it looks like an old boys club. I mean, there are some women, but it's really affluent people. They've known each other for a long time.
Without a doubt.
They're all buddies, just the way Mueller is a buddy with Barr and at DEA set up really a system starting in the early 1990s for mass bulk data collection of Americans on the pretext of the war on drugs. I mean, yeah, he's going to get confirmed, and they're not asking the right questions. They're not making the right challenges. That's the problem.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from Seattle by Brad Schlesinger. He's a criminal defense attorney there. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The New York Times reported today that a year ago, President Trump suggested to aides that the United States should withdraw from NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He made the statement several more times throughout 2018, calling it a financial drain on the U.S. A U.S. withdrawal would likely signal the end of the alliance. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Peter Kuznick. He's a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, and he's the co-author with Oliver Stone of the book and the hit Showtime series, The Untold History of the United States. Welcome back, Peter.
Glad to be with you guys.
Peter, is this a real threat, or is this just the president ruminating?
And why is it a threat?
This might be a good thing.
in a lot of ways, it would be a good thing.
Yeah.
But the problem is that Trump does everything. Even when Trump does the right thing, he manages to do it in an absurdly disastrous way. You know, this is not the kind of thing that should be happening through threats or tweets. And it should not be done because the Europeans are not carrying their weight when it comes to spending on the military. We're spending too much on the military. The Europeans have had the good sense to not want to spend 4% of their GDP like the U.S. does on the military. So I praise them for that. They shouldn't give in to Trump's blustering about paying more and carrying out their commitment. But that doesn't mean that ending NATO would be a bad thing. In a lot of ways, I mean, if you look at the article in the New York Times that you mentioned, the opening paragraph, there are a few things that President Vladimir Putin of Russia desires more than the weakening of NATO, the military alliance among the U.S., Europe, and Canada that has deterred Soviet and Russian aggression for 70 years. So, I mean, the premise is nonsensical. And the idea that Putin's got this grand scheme for global conquest and the only thing that's holding him back is NATO and American threats, it's an absurdist assumption that many Western military analysts actually entertain. So I think the whole context in which we think about this question needs to be different.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, too, what NATO has done for security in Europe. Post 9/11, we were able to convince NATO allies that they needed to fight in Afghanistan because we construed that as a actual war and aggression against the United States.
Yeah, we see how well that one's gone.
Yeah, uh-huh. But what has NATO actually done in Europe?
Libya is part of Europe, right? Because they were NATO bombed Libya and destroyed a sovereign government there and created chaos in the emergence of ISIS and the return of actual African slavery on the African continent. I mean, yeah.
NATO has been involved with bombing multiple countries, got involved with Kosovo, and has been involved in other situations also. The problem is, we go back, NATO was founded in 1949, so we're talking about the 70th anniversary. And 1949 was a crucial year. It was an important turning point. Maybe you could say that the Cold War had already been solidified by that point. But 1949 was the year that the Chinese Revolution occurred. 1949 was also the year that the Soviets tested their atomic bomb. So the world was changing dramatically at that point. And the NATO alliance is seen at that point as a way to counter the expansion of communism, our mortal enemy, in that period. So it's crucial for the development of the Cold War. The Cold War itself was a disaster, and we're lucky to have survived that. But more recently, when Gorbachev allowed the unification of Germany in 1990, he got a promise from the United States and Germany that NATO would not expand one inch, one thumb's width to the east. And NATO has now expanded 13 countries to the east. Most recently, we've put another 5,000 troops into Eastern Europe. So the standoff that's taking place in the Baltics, on the one hand between this expanded NATO force, and then the Russians putting troops on their side, as well as putting nuclear-capable Iskander missiles into Kaliningrad, this is one of the major hotspots that is a potential powder keg, in a sense. I mean, this is one of those areas where war is a real possibility. And we just need to step back. Trump's instincts on this are probably right, that NATO is not a force for peace at this point, and that it's heightening the fear of this Russian ogre that's threatening the West. And Putin is not aggressive in that way. Putin acts defensively. When NATO, in 2008, George Bush said he wanted to expand NATO to Ukraine and Georgia. That was Putin's red line. And so when the United States began to move on that with the coup in Ukraine, clearly Putin stood up, taking back Crimea. Crimea was a ridiculous move on Khrushchev's part in the first place in 1954 when he handed it to Ukraine. It had been part of the Soviet Union, always part of Russia. And there was not a lot of support in Crimea for staying aligned with Kiev rather than with Moscow. They should have had a different kind of referendum, maybe one that was actually more legitimate than the one that occurred. But clearly, the people there are overwhelmingly in favor of their alliance with Russia. But the United States, which propelled the effort to wrest Ukraine away from the Russian sphere of influence, knew what it was doing. I mean, they knew that Russia was going to respond with taking Ukraine out. The deal that was demanded, the Financial Times makes a good case of this. If you read the Financial Times coverage, it says that this was the culmination of a decades-long effort to wrest Ukraine away from Russian sphere of influence. If you go back to Brzezinski, writing in 1997, or Hadley and Scooter Libby and some of the others, say very clearly that without Ukraine, that Russia could not have any pretense to being a major power, or certainly not any kind of global empire. And so this is part of a long-term strategy, and NATO has played that game. So that's why I don't regret the dissolution of NATO, but I'd like to see it replaced by something positive, not as a war-fighting mechanism, but as something that's going to help ease tensions, reduce tensions, and move us toward a more peaceful world.
It's important what Peter Kuznick, Professor Kuznick, is saying, John. In February 1990, George H.W. Bush's Secretary of State, James Baker, assured his Soviet counterpart, Edward Shevardnadze, that in a post-Cold War Europe, NATO would no longer be a belligerent. Quote, less of a military organization, much more of a political one, would have no need for independent capability, meaning military capability. That's what James Baker told the Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze at the time. The National Security Archive released 30 documents that they had received as from a public records request. Helmut Kohl, who later became Chancellor of Germany, also reassured the Soviets and the Russians at that time that NATO would not expand east. Now we know it's expanded to include all of the former Soviet and Russian allies from the Cold War, which would include Central and East European governments. Here's what Helmut Kohl said, Peter Kuznick. We believe that NATO should not expand the sphere of its activity. We have to find a reasonable resolution. I correctly understand the security interests of the Soviet Union, and I realize that you, General Secretary, and the Soviet leadership will have to clearly explain what is happening to the Soviet people. There's Helmut Kohl, future Chancellor of Germany, saying, we promise you that if the Cold War ends and the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet military alliance, the Soviet-led military alliance was disbanded, we promise you we won't move eastward. But precisely that's what NATO has done. That's why we are in a new Cold War, partly at least. Go ahead, Peter.
It's a very big factor in Putin's thinking and all the Russians' thinking. When I go over there and talk to Russian officials, NATO is always at the top of their list, and they feel betrayed. I mean, they feel that they were promised something, and then it was reversed. Gorbachev made the mistake of trusting these jokers, of not getting it in writing. And a lot of the criticism of Gorbachev now in Russia is that he was too naive and that he should have certainly gotten this in writing. But we know what he was told, and I don't think anybody doubts that he certainly believed that NATO was not going to expand. He said that repeatedly since then, and for good reason. But as we're saying, it's expanded right up to Russia's doorstep, and it's an armed alliance, and it poses a threat. Now, other things, I mean, if we look at Europe, one of the positive things that came out of the resolutions in the late 1980s was the INF Treaty. Trump, while on the one hand saying maybe he wants to withdraw from NATO, has also withdrawn from the INF Treaty. And the INF Treaty removed an entire category of nuclear weapons that were threatening war between Russia and the Europeans in the 1980s. So those SS-20s and the missiles that we were able to eliminate, now there's the threat of a new Cold War, a new nuclear arms race. Trump, in that initial phone conversation with Putin said we should talk about extending the New START treaty, the major nuclear treaty, when this one expires in 2021. And Trump puts down the phone and he asks his advisors, well, what's the New START treaty? Gets back on the phone, says, no, it's a terrible treaty. We're not going to extend it. So on the one hand, Trump does some occasional things like Syria that make some sense. But on the other hand, he's doing absurd things that make the world more dangerous. And so he goes both directions at the same time.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Peter Kuznick. He's a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. And he's also the co-author with Oliver Stone of the book and the hit Showtime television series, The Untold History of the United States. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Los Angeles teacher strike entered its second day today with no immediate end in sight. Why won't the LA Unified School District reduce class sizes, hire more nurses, counselors, and librarians, and give teachers a raise when the district is sitting on a $1.86 billion surplus? Today, huge pickets are continuing and charter school teachers are joining the strike. We're joined from Los Angeles by Cecily Meyert-Cruz. She's been a teacher in the LA Unified School District for 23 years, and she's the vice president of United Teachers Los Angeles, National Education Association, the Teachers Union. Welcome back, Cecily.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. I'm out at my former school site today, and the resolve is very clear that teachers want what students need.
Well, tell us what day one was like. This was major news nationally yesterday.
Yes, the news was incredible. Let me just tell you, the feeling was so vibrant and energetic. We had a torrential downpour in Southern California yesterday, and it didn't deter folks' resolve. We were out in the streets en masse. We had over 50,000 folks out there. It has been absolutely remarkable that educators all over have been at the forefront.
Yeah, I saw it on TV last night. I have to say, it was so inspiring. Mm-hmm. We had all of these teacher strikes last year, and again, the labor movement is changing. I mean, it's largely women, lower paid jobs, not necessarily industrial jobs, but it's not only the teachers fighting for themselves, maybe not even mainly for themselves. They're fighting for their students. They're fighting for their communities. They're fighting for their parents. And right now, Cecily, I would say teachers are fighting for all of labor because the labor movement and working class people in America have been pushed back so hard for the past four decades. This is exactly what's needed.
That's right. You are absolutely right. Privatization is at an all-time high, and our superintendent is no stranger to that. He is the Betsy DeVos of Los Angeles. He has zero educational experience.
Wow.
However, he is running the second largest school district, and he really wants to continue his investment banking ways to downsize our school district and cripple us. But like I said, the resolve here out at picket lines and yesterday was amazing.
I have to ask you about this $1.86 billion surplus that the district has. I had no idea that this existed until I saw it in the national news yesterday. Why isn't this being used for the students? Why isn't this being used to reduce class sizes and to hire more teachers and counselors, et cetera?
And that's a good question. Actually, just to correct you, it's $1.93 billion. So we want to know this exact same thing. This is the highest rainy day fund reserve in the entire country, and that is ridiculous.
Yeah, and again, we have a big $1.9 billion in L.A. Also, the budget for the state of California is $8.8 billion, and the governor, Jerry Brown, says, oh, we're going to keep all of it for our rainy day fund. Well, you know what? For school teachers and for kids in the public schools in Los Angeles, it's a rainy day. Not in a literal sense, but in a figurative sense, it's a rainy day because if you're trying to learn math and you have 50 kids or 52 kids in a classroom and some of them are standing in the back, that rainy day is right now.
The rainy day is right now, and we're saying that it is just absolutely crazy to think that the district can't see past their monetizing ways. Over 80% of Over 80% of our nurses, there are no nurses in our schools. We're looking for PSAs. We're looking for psychologists. We are looking for counselors. These are the supports our students need. And they can't wait. They've been waiting. They've been waiting for over 25 years. So, yes, this is important because it's now. If we are really saying that our students are the future, then why aren't we continually putting them last? In California, we're the fifth largest global economy in the world, but we hover around 43 to 48 out of the state in per pupil funding. And I think I said it before, but I hope it doesn't fall on deaf ears, that we spend more money incarcerating youth to the tune of $75,560 to education, which is at $10,291.
Cecily, we hear horns in the background, car horns. Are those people expressing support?
Yes. Folks have been honking, driving up, giving donuts, giving water to our striking teachers, restaurants giving food, churches opening up their locations for restrooms. This city loves Los Angeles, and they love teachers and educators alike.
What happens next in terms of the negotiations? Are there negotiations scheduled?
No, there are no negotiations scheduled. We asked the district to give us a proposal, not put it into the media, but actually come to the table and give us a real proposal, not a fake one where they're saying, oh, we're going to give you 6% with contingencies, rolling back health benefits, or trying to, and with strings attached, they said, oh, we're going to have an additional 1,200 more staff. Isn't that enough? But they are only having those additional staff for 1 year. So that means schools have to choose between a nurse, between a PSA, between a class size reduction teacher. Do you think that our kids can wait? I say no, they can't. They've been waiting for 25 years, and now's the time to act.
We're talking with the vice president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles. Cecily, again, another statistic, the number of people in poverty and the number of children in poverty in California, it's mind-blowing. We mentioned it last week. California has the highest rate of childhood poverty in the country, greater than Mississippi, greater than Alabama. California, the rate is 22.8%. For Los Angeles County, the number is 28.8%. You know, Charles Dickens wrote the book, The Tale of Two Cities. We could talk about California as the tale of two states. There's one state for the rich, the very, very, very rich, and there's many, of course, a small percentage of the population. But then there's another part of the population, which is maybe not rich, but very affluent. But then you have this vast mass of the population, which is extremely poor, because the poverty statistics are such that if you had double the income of what would qualify as official poverty, you'd still be poor because it's an understated official, understated statistic. Again, it says a lot about priorities, and it seems to me that when people think about this strike, as they're going to be told, oh, the teachers are inconveniencing people, when they think about the strike, they have to think, you know what, the teachers, and it seems to me the teachers alone and their allies are the ones who are fighting for this vast swath of the population in California that's poor.
Yes, totally agree with that statement. We have 80% of our folks, our students, that are free and reduced lunch. We know that, and that's the key point. How long do folks have to wait for answers? How long do folks have to wait for actual investments in schools? There's been a systematic disinvestment in public education. We know that it's a playbook where they cry broke on purpose. They blame the teachers. They starve the schools, and then they give them away. That's what's being done. We've seen it done in New Orleans. You've seen it happen in Newark, Indianapolis. So I can keep going on. Michigan, we know. And we here in LA are saying no more. We are taking up this fight because this is a broader movement. It is a broader fight to really save the soul of public education.
Cecily, if we looked at a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being the greatest, what's the morale of the teachers who are on strike right now? We have about 45 seconds left.
The morale is at a 10. If you could have seen the folks yesterday in the torrential downpour and the folks out on the line, people have said, hey, I made it through the rain yesterday. I can make it through today.
Fantastic. We wish you the very best of luck. That was the voice of Cecily Myart-Cruz. She joined us from Los Angeles. She's been a teacher in the LA Unified School District for 23 years, and she's the vice president of United Teachers Los Angeles, National Education Association, the Teachers Union. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our regular segment, which we do every Tuesday, called Women in Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Hannah Dickinson is a professor, and she's an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. She will be joining every week from Geneva, New York, but again this week she joins us from London. Welcome back.
Thanks so much. Happy to be back.
Well, we're happy to have you. Let's start with a piece that appeared in the Huffington Post. I actually have a question about this. The Huffington Post and some local news outlets around the country are reporting that domestic violence shelters are preparing for the worst by cutting services, all but their most essential costs, and planning for layoffs. And women and children in rural areas are going to be particularly impacted. But why? Is this because of the government shutdown, the federal shutdown, and them not getting federal funds or matching funds? Or is it something else that's happening out there?
Great question, John. Yeah, there are a few factors here. The primary one is that the Violence Against Women Act, which provides resources and protections for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, expired when the shutdown went into effect. So the vast majority of domestic violence shelters, particularly those in rural areas and particularly those serving Native women and communities, rely almost entirely on federal funding to support the work they do already on sort of shoestring budget. So that's a major component. There are some other features like concern from workers at the shelters about how reimbursement is going to work. Again, they're not working with big budgets. And so because they don't know when and if they'll be reimbursed because they're not workers to answer their questions about reimbursements or put those reimbursements through, there's just an incredible amount of anxiety about how long they'll be able to go on doing their work. And this is not to mention HUD, WIC, and other kinds of services that domestic violence shelters often are connecting women and families with.
I want to say, too, there's a domestic violence shelter in my neighborhood. It's unmarked for the safety of the women and children inside. And in tough times like this, it's particularly reliant on the generosity of neighbors. And so don't forget that Goodwill and Salvation Army aren't the only charities out there that need your clothes and your household items. Think about these shelters too, because they really are in need of our help.
I'm glad you brought that up, John. We've seen already in the last week or so domestic violence shelters, sexual assault hotlines reaching out to community volunteers saying, we need your help and we need your money because we can't provide basic services. I mean, we're talking about money for women to take a cab from their home to the domestic violence shelter. And we know, right, that these are the kinds of situations that if folks don't get out in the moment they make that decision, they could be at real risk.
Yeah. And many times when a woman makes a decision to leave, she leaves with only her children and the clothes on their back. They don't pack up the house and move their household furnishings and clothes and stuff. They flee for their safety. So they have literally nothing.
I just add, I mean, sort of to frame this in the larger political context, because what's happening locally is really important, but it's also just so troubling for what it tells us about the Trump administration and the federal government's priorities, right? So as the shutdown gets framed around keeping essential services intact, like the military, like Border Patrol, like police and fire, it raises some real questions for me about why don't we think support for survivors of intimate partner violence, that's not essential, right? We have sort of a fantasy about the horrible violence at our border somehow coming in and threatening all Americans' lives, when one in four women will experience intimate partner violence in her lifetime in her own home. And yet that's not essential service, right? That's not violence we need to be worrying about at a federal level somehow.
I think in many ways, that's the most important point to take away from this discussion, because if we look at the problems that women in society face with sexual violence, abuse, much of it coming from intimate partners, from husbands or boyfriends, from family members, for women and girls, we see that there's an epidemic of this. We're always talking, and the media is always talking about how many people died from terrorism or how many people died from this, that, or the other thing. The biggest killer in America are men killing women. The biggest source of violence is men committing violence against women. I mean, that's just a fact. That's not rhetoric. That's a fact. And yet the government doesn't treat it like that. As a matter of fact, when you read the newspapers, you know, it's always buried in the Metro section. Another woman was shot dead by her estranged husband or boyfriend. It's always like a two-sentence article in the Metro section, where if somebody got killed, an American got killed by a Muslim who may have been affiliated with a mosque or with a religious and political party, that would be like front page news. But the real killer in America, in terms of proportionality, is this. It's not treated like that. And again, I'm so happy, Professor Dickinson, that you made the point. Why would this not be an essential service when you're talking about, quote, national security for millions of women? I mean, literally millions of women, their security and thus the security of people throughout the nation is at risk, not from a foreign foe, but from a domestic abuser.
That's right. And we know that some of the major factors that contribute to domestic violence are financial insecurity, are a lack of social safety nets, lack of access to mental health treatment, right? So again, when we sort of pull back, we can see the ways in which the shutdown, increased austerity measures, a reduction in the social safety net, right, just contributes to what you've rightly called an epidemic, Brian. And again, there's no framing of that somehow as an issue of national security. It's totally naturalized, rather than recognizing that this is actually a problem that could be solved with meaningful social supports that the shutdown is exacerbating in a whole bunch of ways.
Let's go into the next issue. It concerns a march this Saturday. This is kind of exciting. I've participated in a lot of these marches that are massive in scope, and I think this is going to be one. This Saturday, hundreds of thousands of women and their supporters are expected to march for gender justice worldwide. Here in D.C. is going to be one of the big ones. But talk a little bit about the reasons for this march and how people can get involved.
Thanks. Yeah. So again, a little history and context here I think is important. If we can remember, 2 years ago, the day after Trump's inauguration, 5 million people participated in marches in the U.S. under the broad rubric Women's March, arguably the largest single day demonstration in recorded U.S. history. And people, women and their supporters, they're marching not just for traditional women's issues, abortion, contraception, equal pay, those things are crucial and important. But it was also a sort of historic moment for linking those traditional women's issues with struggles for justice in a whole bunch of ways, right? Trans women's rights, indigenous people's rights, environmental justice. I think this was sort of a moment in which not only was the feminist fight back ignited, but we started having those really important conversations about what does feminism mean in the 21st century in the U.S.? How do we make sure that women's issues help frame the future we want to bring about. And I think we can see the kinds of incredible grassroots energy that First March sparked, the wave of teacher strikes, which I know we'll talk about later. And so I know, right, for myself, organizing in a small town, we really look forward every year to participating in the Women's March for that moment of standing up and saying that women are on the front lines of the struggle for justice in a whole bunch of ways. Last year in Seneca Falls, where I marched, 12,000 women and their supporters came out. That's nearly twice the population of Seneca Falls. So I know there's been all kinds of controversy this year about the Women's March, but I will just say that that hasn't, that kind of media narrative, it doesn't fit the everyday organizing experience that I have and that I have with the folks, at least in the small town in which I live.
Professor Dickinson, time goes so fast. We have 1 minute left. We're going to cover this later in the show, but there's a strike going on in Los Angeles. It's teachers. It's 30,000 people and education professionals. They're not all women, but it's women in leadership here, again, in Los Angeles. And we saw that with the wave of strikes last year. 1 minute left. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the reason I really wanted to talk about the LA teacher strike on this segment is because, for two reasons. One, the exciting continuation of the strike wave here gives us a different picture of the face of labor in the U.S. today than the media often paints it as. It's not some fantasy white male worker. These teachers are majority female. They're majority non-white. This is the face of labor and union struggles in the U.S. today. And the kind of work that teachers are doing, work we might call care work or social reproductive work, is really significant in terms of thinking about what work looks like in the U.S. today, right? Schools are the hub of social services. These teachers are on the front lines, not of making cars, but making and remaking people, right? So rather, they are the ones saying, don't siphon money off into charter schools, public money, right? We need it here because what it is to be a teacher or a librarian or a counselor in a public school today is about so much more than reading and writing and arithmetic. It's about building a sustainable future, supporting young people, and that kind of care work needs to be valued and valorized.
That was the voice of Hannah Dickinson. She joined us from London. She's a professor and she's an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Representative Steve King, a Republican of Iowa, will be stripped of his committee assignments because of racist comments he made last week. But King has been making similar comments for years, and the Republican leadership has never said a word. Senator Chuck Grassley even endorsed him for re-election just last year. So why are the Republicans acting now? And does this mean the end of King's career? We're joined from Philadelphia by Dr. Nazia Kazi. She's an activist and professor of anthropology at Stockton University, and she's the author of the new book, Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics. Welcome back.
Good to be back.
So there are some developments in this, I guess we could call it a case, this story. One is that Liz Cheney, the highest ranking woman on the Republican side in the House of Representatives, today called on King to resign. He has not done that yet. And also, a motion of censure has been introduced in the House by Representative Tim Ryan, a Democrat of Ohio. Now, in the case of censure, if this passes, King would have to stand in the well of the House of Representatives and be formally rebuked by his colleagues. It's humiliating. It's embarrassing. And most people, if they are to be censured, resign just so they don't have to go through it. How do you see this playing out?
I think that in this moment, it would serve us well to remember a quote from Noam Chomsky. Chomsky says, the smart way to keep people obedient is to strictly limit the spectrum of acceptable opinion, but allow very lively debate within that spectrum. Okay, so now you have these Republicans coming out and condemning Steve King, who has had a long history of making really just kind of cartoonishly outlandish anti-immigrant, anti-woman, and racist statements. But the danger of this moment is that the moves that the Republicans are making, and the Democrats for that matter, are really kind of a chance for them to redeem themselves. I mean, do you think any of these elected officials would support anti-racist measures, land or economic reforms to better serve America's indigenous populations, any measures to repair the damage done through the centuries of unpaid labor provided by enslaved people? And do you think any of them actually want to stop the wars of aggression that have led to the types of immigration crises that Steve King hates? I doubt it. There's this really rhetorical kind of focus on racism here that I think actually serves to distract us from the systemic foundational realities of, you know, of American racism. And obviously this comes after the November elections when the Republicans lost a whole bunch of House seats, and now they need to sort of compensate for that.
That's the voice of Dr. Nazia Kazi. She is an activist, also a professor of anthropology at Stockton University. She's the author of a new book called Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics. Dr. Kazi, I agree with you 100% on this. What Steve King did was go a little bit too far with the language when he said, a white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? He kind of crossed that line. But all of these other racists in Congress or in the White House carry out and support and endorse the same policies, but are a little bit more savvy in terms of language. Now, if you went back 100 years, or even 50 years, some of this same language would have been a commonplace within and among politicians, but now it's considered verboten. But again, it's only about the language. It's not about the essence of the policy.
That's absolutely right. And I think really one of the tragic features of how we talk about race in the U.S. is that we understand it as a matter of attitudes. You know, we understand it as a matter of personal prejudice, individual bigotry, instead of, you know, the ways our economic system, our housing system, our educational system are structured. If your listeners haven't, I would urge them to check out a book by Ian Haney Lopez called Dog Whistle Politics that does a really terrific job of kind of laying out how it is we got to this place where Americans are so offended by this overtly racist language, but are, you know, hardly affected by the day-to-day kind of commonplace foundational elements of American racism.
Indeed. In this country, people are additionally focused, hyper-focused on language. Language is the gauge of whether or not you're on the right side or the wrong side. And of course, for elites who have some degree of political sophistication, language can be easily adjusted so as to camouflage the essence of a policy, the essence of an orientation, or the institutions of race discrimination or discrimination against women or the LGBTQ community. William Barr, who's about to be, you know, confirmed, I would think, probably by the Democrats and Republicans as the new attorney general, was the, you know, out there advocate for creating a system of mass incarceration when he was attorney general in 1992 and 1993. I mean, that's a system of institutionalized white supremacy. It's not directed only against black and brown people, but disproportionately has impacted black and brown individuals and whole communities. It's a system, but as long as you don't use overtly racist language, you're cool. That's good. You're fine, as long as you know how to talk. And of course, talking and the use of language and words by sophisticated people for time immemorial has been mastered by whatever the ruling class was at a particular social epoch.
Yeah, and I think that's why the Trump presidency has been such a crisis for the ruling establishment, as you call them, because he doesn't behave in the ways that are sort of marked by the same sort of genteel, you know, presidential politics that we're used to. I mean, I remember when Obama was running for office and he correctly pronounced the name of the country Pakistan, which we're all too used to hearing pronounced Pakistan, right, by our elected officials, and people thinking that that was really exciting. So what fell out of the picture was what ended up happening, which was Obama's policy vis-a-vis the Muslim world, in many ways continuing that of Bush before him. But, you know, he could at least pronounce, at least he said the word nuclear instead of nuclear. and that became the object of everyone's focus.
Oh, you are so right.
No, that's absolutely right. The way some liberals and progressives made fun of George W. Bush because of the way he spoke, as if that was an issue. It doesn't really matter how people speak. I mean, not that language doesn't matter. It does matter, but it's not the essence of things. And of course, there's other ways of speaking that are, you know, barely camouflage, but send the same white supremacist sort of story and narrative. Let's not forget Ronald Reagan, who is now like a hero for all sides of the political establishment, Republican and Democrat. He began his 1980 presidential bid by going to Philadelphia, Mississippi. I mean, no one would go to Philadelphia, Mississippi to start a presidential campaign except for the symbolism. That's where the three civil rights workers were slain in 1964. And then during that week and weeks, Reagan coined the phrase, "The South shall rise again." I mean, again, Ronald Reagan is not characterized as a white supremacist, but clearly that was a movement and a campaign based on white supremacy.
Absolutely. I mean, it was just last week, and the story didn't get as much press than it might have. A Texas County GOP group actually had a heated debate on whether or not this Muslim man could hold his position as vice chair.
Yeah.
Because of his Muslim identity.
It came to a vote.
And yeah, exactly. And, you know, ultimately they ended up ruling in his favor. I'm not sure why this Muslim man wants to be a Republican. But, you know, this happened. This is the commonplace reality of racism and xenophobia in the U.S.
Yeah. We only have about 90 seconds left. What should be the most important part of the progressive message in response to this? Because I can see, again, because there's this kind of herd instinct where now everybody's going to like, hey, let's get together and hate Steve King, which of course is true, should be, and it's a righteous thing. But nonetheless, it seems to me to be sort of diminishing the political, I don't know, the political level of progressive anti-racist forces who just join this campaign and say, see how bad that Steve King is, and maybe it's really necessary and good that the Republicans did this. This may be sort of a saving grace for the Republicans. What's our main message here?
I think our main message is exactly what you're pointing to. We need to look at the deep roots of what actually leads to the type of racism that we hear coming from Steve King. And it's not an anomaly. It's not an anomaly at all. It is rooted in the everyday functioning of both of our political parties and our inability to deal with the historic and enduring realities of white supremacy as it has affected America's indigenous, America's immigrants, and America's black folks historically.
Dr. Nazia Kazi is our guest. She's an activist and a professor of anthropology at Stockton University. Dr. Kazi, you are the author of this new book, Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics. Explain the title, if you would. What's your main thesis? We have about a minute left, and I'd like to have you also tell the audience how they can actually find your book.
Sure. So the book can be found online, Amazon, but also at the publisher's website at Roman and Littlefield. And the book is really kind of an introduction to the topic of Islamophobia and how it connects to a long history of both white supremacy within the U.S. and America's process of empire building abroad. And it's not an academic book. 19-year-olds are reading it in college classes right now. So it's meant to be very accessible.
I really want to encourage people to get this book by Dr. Kazi. It's Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics, published by Roman and Littlefield. John, I think we're out of time.
We are. We were joined from Philadelphia by Dr. Nazia Kazi. She's an activist and professor of anthropology at Stockton University. And don't forget, she's the author of that new book, Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics. You can get it from the publisher, Roman and Littlefield. You can also get it on Amazon and elsewhere. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.